Welcome. This is episode 4 of You Missed It? I'm Alex, your host. And with me, as usual, is Jack, Rylan, Zach, and Andrew. And they had to suffer through, well, depending upon their opinion, we'll find that out in a minute, my pick for this week, a film titled SFW. No, it does not stand for Safe for Work, although if you look that up on YouTube, you'll get some interesting results. And no, don't confuse it as SJW, as some of you youngsters are ought to do.
I'm sorry.
So SFW stands for So Fucking What, a phrase you will hear a few times throughout this film.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. Film was shot, I think, in early 1994 or late 1993, and I'll give a reason for that in a minute. It was released in the United States on approximately January 20th, 1995. It stars Stephen Dorff and Reese Witherspoon. They play Cliff Spab and Wendy Pfister, respectively. They are two of five remaining hostages from a hostage situation that went over a period of 36 days at a convenience store called the Fun Stop. A little bit ironic, depending on your interpretation of the word. Anyway, so 36 days hostage situation. One of the things with the hostage situation was the terrorists. There were four of them in total. They had guns, of course. And they also had a video camera. And they recorded everything over that 36-day period. And when they sent the tapes to the media at first refused to air the footage, of course. So, two hostages were killed. And then the media finally relented, airing the footage. Now, airing the footage live or just sending the tapes out, I don't think we ever found that out. However,
I was under the impression they were doing it live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those cameras didn't look like live cameras, though. They
exactly.
Looked like VHS tapes.
Yeah, they're a bit too small for that time to be broadcasting live, I think. Yeah,
they were making regular installments at any rate.
Yeah. So, at the end of that 36-day period, Wendy and Cliff survive, and then they have to deal with the repercussions of surviving, which was fame. And that's basically what the rest of the film deals with, is having to deal with being a reality star, you could call it. Mm-hmm. Because they were really living through it and having to relive it over and over and over again on TV. So, I'll go to my left. Jack, being a film lover that you are, What did you think of it, number one? And number two, were there any themes to the film? And if so, what were they?
I'll go with the latter first of what you were asking. In terms of themes, the only one that I kind of came up with was that this was a prime example of capitalization of a tragedy or of celebrity. You know, that's pretty much what it all was. Everyone sort of circling the two main characters, who Cliff and Wendy. Everyone around him was just like, don't screw this up for me, otherwise it's going to cost me a lot of money. Everyone's into that. So definitely it was just seeing how, and with the ending of the movie too, how it's just a cycle. It just keeps happening over and over again. I did like the movie. I thought it was actually really well directed. I thought the direction and how the camera was used, how it was moved, the pacing, the editing, I thought was handled really well, and something that I kind of miss from a lot of modern films, to be perfectly honest. It felt like there was an actual vision, you know, it wasn't just like a hire for direct type of movie. Like clearly, like I think the person who wrote this movie also was the director, or one of the people who wrote the film also directed it. So it just came across as, this is a passion project. This comes off as, you know, someone who has spent a long time thinking about this kind of idea and how it should come across, because I couldn't see anyone else really taking a stab at this idea. Now, obviously, it's funny how I've personally seen Stronger just recently with Jake Gyllenhaal, and there's a lot of similar themes about having to deal with all of a sudden becoming a celebrity for something that you don't want to revisit, that you don't want to talk about, the worst experience, and how you're being told over and over again to revisit it, talk about it, you're a hero to me, and all that stuff. Just the celebrity that becomes of individual sometimes can have, you know, dark meanings to it. And yeah, so that's sort of my first initial sum up. So yeah, nice. No, I did enjoy it. I thought it was good.
Nice. Cool. Rylan, what did you think of it?
I really enjoyed this movie. I was going into it completely blind, not knowing what to expect at all. But, and yeah, you've got yourself a very unusual premise to start off with. But I think it's even more interesting that it doesn't focus on this premise of the hostage situation. It's all about the aftermath. In this case, it's like Jack was saying, dealing with the fame that you didn't ask for and you don't want. And in a sense, the characters of Cliff and Wendy are almost still in a kind of prison of their own because they're constantly being hounded by the media. I mean, Cliff's just, you know, come out of this massive tragedy. He watched his friend get shot trying to save them, and then he comes out of the hospital, and then he's got his own parents whoring him out to the media for press conferences and stuff. So yeah, I mean, his character is the type who just tries to take it in stride and deal with it, because he's not fooled. He knows that he's just basically the next kind of passing commodity here, that his tragedy just happens to be kind of the next fad, and he's just trying to ride it out and not taking himself too seriously. So I applaud the character for that. But yeah, more the movie is about like trauma or tragedy for profit, and how the media are basically just like vultures kind of feeding on that type of stuff, and we as consumers essentially are part of the problem as well. And I find that even though this was made in the 90s, a lot of this is still relevant today with how the media and social media and how just we as consumers kind of observe and consume the charitable merchandise consuming the television programs, the magazines, the exposés, just with the way that the viral culture is even more prevalent now than it was when the movie was made. Yes. But I feel like there's a lot of similarities into how just the general public reacts to this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And it all starts with, how do you feel? And then shoving a microphone in your face, because it's always about emotion. How do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that, like, more recently? I think it was, it was during the flooding in Houston. There was a reporter that tried to get a statement, like, basically said that. It was, somebody who's dealing with this natural disaster, and then one of the reporters comes up and just says, how do you feel?
Yeah.
And she loses her shit.
I saw that video, actually. Yeah, she's just like,
yeah,
what do you think this is the worst time
of my life right now, and you're putting a microphone in my face? And then it put the reporter in an awkward situation of either pulling the mic away and looking bad doing that, or letting her keep going, and it's also still awkward for her. So
mm-hmm.
She wasn't in a good. She's obviously getting pressure as well to like cover this as well. But that's real life example.
Get your
of
fucking
that, right?
soundbite somewhere else.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's like that. We just want to hear it's bad. Like, it's so bad. This sucks. Like, mm-hmm. You know that already. You know, you're just harassing these people.
Yeah, they have a narrative. They have an agenda. You know, that's in the end of things. You know,
they just want a barely in context quip that they can put in their clickbait headline. That's really all.
Exactly,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's all part of the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Rather said something to the effect of, when you're a journalist and you get away from the desk and you sit in front of a camera, you're getting out of the news business and you're getting into show business.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So then it becomes over-dramatized, and it's all about ratings and how much money you can make and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-fucking-blah.
Yeah, most people you see on camera nowadays, they're not technically journalists. They're more actors who know how to read lines well, because that's all it is. They're just reading lines that have been overproduced, overwritten, to the point of, like, you got to meet a certain guidelines because, you know, otherwise you're going to lose sponsors or, you know, get into trouble, or mm-hmm. you're going to piss off the wrong individual because you just had an opinion and anything like that. So, yeah, that definitely is very topical, and I think it's always been topical. Mm-hmm. But,
Yeah, no thought of people, but only thought about like ratings and money and shit like that. It's pretty much it. That's all that drives them. Yeah.
And since you're talking, because you're a huge music guy and you're wearing an Obituary shirt.
Yes.
I'm going to, of course, ask, what did you think of the film? How did it make you feel? But number two, what did you think about the music used? Because this is 1995 when it was released. It was being cut in 94. So there was a lot going on music-wise at the time. So they had a lot to pick from. And you got to hear Radiohead and Soundgarden and Hole, three examples. So do you think the music fit, or was it like just shoved in there gratuitously?
Well, first of all, you know, I was going to review this movie, but so fucking what?
Out come the dad jokes. Oh, yeah.
Ooh, baby. No, I really liked it. Like going along with the music and everything, it was very 90s. It was very of its time, but in a good way. Like I still like, you know, how that era was represented and everything, but also how it's, you know, still relevant today in terms of what they were talking about and everything. And I was going to say too that, the soundtrack I really enjoyed, actually. I thought it worked, not only like was just really good in general. I liked the music they picked, but it worked well even with the story and stuff. Like when they played Creep by Radiohead, like I liked how he was just kind of like wandering alone and stuff like that, and kind of looking at this like crazy world that's like revolving around him, and he's just kind of like, so fucking what?
He's become a product and it springs up around him,
right? But it was a neat subject too, because the thing was all I'd seen was the trailer. Like I never heard about this movie, so that's how I knew, like, oh, it's called So Fucking What. That's what SFW stood for. And I was under the impression that, funny enough, in the trailer, I don't know how I got this, but almost had the opposite view, where it was like they were keeping people hostage. That's what I thought before I came into this movie. I thought like Reese Witherspoon and Stephen Dorff were keeping people hostage, and they kind of like set up this whole like, you know, TV show kind of thing. But then I was very wrong about that. They were indeed the hostages. And then also the movie, you know, doesn't sit, you know, in that like convenience store the whole time too. It kind of flashes back to it, whereas I thought it'd be like a typical 90s thing, like where it's like all in one location and okay, we're gonna have this like hostage situation, but it's gonna only take place here, which is a very 90s, you know, indie kind of thing. And I was surprised that it's like, oh, that's just like the setup, but the real movie is like kind of after you know what had happened. It reminded me a little bit, like Jack had pointed out, Stronger, which is a really good comparison. Another one, interestingly enough, was Room, a little bit. How that one, it's all about somebody being in, obviously in different, somewhat of a different circumstance, but kind of similar, who ends up getting out, but the movie ain't over yet. It's like the big part of the movie is what happens after.
Yeah.
Right. And kind of all the tolls that takes and, you know, yada, yada, in a very different way, but still kind of similar, you know, which I thought was really cool. But yeah, overall, I liked the performances. I thought the comedy was really good too. I was surprised actually how comedic it was, but I also liked how obviously the event kept creeping up, and obviously that would happen if you were in an event like that, something that tragic and, you know, crazy.
Yeah, it's like PTSD.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah, no, I thought it had a really neat vibe to it. Yeah, I really enjoyed it overall.
Nice. So that's 4 out of 5 of us who either liked or really liked the film. So now it's time for the black sheep. Andrew, I know I know this wasn't The Little Prince. Like, it wasn't... It wasn't like the nicest movie, and it wasn't, and Justice for All, so it wasn't the smartest movie, and it wasn't A Simple Plan, because it wasn't the most dramatic movie all the time. Like, it may have had some moral messages, or at least suggestions of which, but I wanted to know what you thought of it as a 90s film, and I say that because I'm the old codger of the group, so I was lucky enough to see the trailer on TV in 1990. It was either 94 or 95. So what did you think of it, considering the other 90s films you've seen? And is this something that you yourself would recommend to people, like considering some of the films you really like, some of your favorite films? Would you tell people, hey, you should see this film? Or would you just brush it off and say, ah, I saw it, didn't really like it?
Okay. Answer those kind of one at a time.
Sorry, it's rapid fire. It's like the media. How do you feel?
I don't know how to process this. I am actually, I still kind of processing it, but for me, it felt really at home in the 90s to answer that question. Yeah, it definitely felt really 90s. Like right away, that's why I think I asked right at the beginning. I'm like, when did this come out? Okay. And they're like, oh, 94, 95, you guys were saying. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. Because that's what immediately I got that vibe. I can just tell, having grown up in that era. So yeah, it absolutely fit the 90s, which is why I'm used to things that came out in the 90s. So I can kind of I can handle that style. There's no problem with that. It kind of just brings me back in a way. It wasn't really the style so much. I'm probably the least stoked about this movie out of everybody here. Which is funny. I don't know why you're like, oh, the black sheep here. Like, I don't know how you knew.
I kind of got some vibes from you, too. You kept looking at me during the movie, and I was like, huh, okay, I wonder if he's liking this.
I saw the themes were there. I understood them. I understood. I you know, it also one that I don't think you guys, like, you guys hit upon, but didn't talk much. It was the end of the film anyway, but the idea that you can turn any event, any public event, into, you can turn people into celebrity that way. So basically, her at the end, they what they are or what they were doing doesn't matter anymore. It's the public discussion that makes them celebrity, and ends up making it becomes more about the conversation and less about the person. Like, she was just crazy. The woman at the end was just kind of nuts. She's clearly just straightforward. You're like, yeah, she's just a criminal. She's just an insane person. Yeah. She just shot this person. Like, 9 times out of 10, case closed. But, you know, they politicized it. They made it this whole media, like, this story. Yeah. And I like that. There are elements that that are relevant to today. I agree with that. I also like the way that it treated post-traumatic stress. It was a pretty good representation of that. I thought, you know, people keep bringing things up. They keep, they did it in a comical way, which I did appreciate. You know, they had like TV movies. You literally had Gary Coleman.
Yes.
You know, it was great. Funny, right? So they kind of made you laugh at it, which was in line with the character. So those things I appreciated. But in terms of getting any kind of a message across, I didn't think it was that impactful as far as the message goes, just because, for me personally, just because it felt like it was always trying to tell you something, but it wasn't saying it in a way, or wasn't showing it in a way that was really that impactful. It was just kind of laughing at it, like, look at this, you know, this issue, how we always take people's stressful situations and we turn them into our thing, which is a serious topic or something worth discussing, but they kind of, you know, just laughed it off. And it makes sense. They kind of turned it into a bit more of a comedy than a drama, which is fine. Again, you can do that, but it also made me take it a little less seriously. It made me kind of laugh at it more.
Gotcha.
Which I don't know that I want to, you know, because I do kind of think this is something interesting, but I feel like I'm not exploring it in depth just because I was laughing all the time, like most of the time, to be honest. Like, there were definitely serious points in the film.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, I thought it was pretty light as far as, I think out of all the films we've watched, I guess obviously besides Little Prince, actually that was a little heavier, I thought, in terms of the tone. I think, well, A Simple Plan is dark as well, but had light elements. I would say this is probably the lightest, the lightest film we've seen so far. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. I did enjoy it, but it just not enough to say that it was, is probably the one I enjoyed the least so far.
Gotcha.
Just on those on those points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So this is not my favorite film, although I do have the DVD, and I'm not one for buying much in the way of CDs or DVDs at this point in my life. Like, that was in my early 20s. I think it was like I was 25 or 26 when I bought my last CD or DVD. Mm-hmm. So it's like media at that point has either become disposable to me mm-hmm. or it's just not worth keeping.
Right.
But there was a reason that I bought this on DVD, and it was, like I said, I had seen the trailer in 1994, 95, and it interested me. But then again, I was 14 years old, mm-hmm. so very, I wouldn't say very young, but still very impressionable. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, for years and years afterward, I had that on various movie lists to watch, and it just, something about it stuck with me. And it was at least 2004 or 2005 when I finally did see the film. And at the time, I was reading books like No Logo by Naomi Klein and If It Bleeds, It Leads, and Anatomy of Television News by Matthew Kerbel. If you can find it, read it. It's great. And I was trying to keep up with the U.S. invasion of Iraq and everything that was going on behind that. And a little bit in diving into conspiracy, like 9/11 and so on.
Right, right, right.
So my little peephole of a view on the world was widening at that time. And it was at that time that I saw SFW. And it really spoke to me the way that I think the film looked at the media and how they treat people as potential products to boost their own ratings and how disgusting that is. Like people are not products. You're not here to ask people how they feel and then just blow up their story and expose them and use them and throw them away. That's not what journalism is about, at least not to me. So I really like the film, but again, it's not my favorite film. I'll watch it every few years to get a laugh or to remind myself not to take the media in this day and age very seriously. Because they've got sponsors, they're corporate shills, in my opinion, in my conspiracy opinion. So
I don't think they're really hiding it anymore.
No,
I think it's you know, any sort of like any sort of veil that they had or a little, you know, curtain that they could pull behind them to hide all of the, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah, Wizard of Oz kind of thing.
Yeah, like that curtain has been burnt down. Like, for the most part, like everything is scrutinized nowadays. Everything is pretty much under the microscope per se. And yeah, no, I think this movie, I do think it's something that because of how it has not, things have not changed. I think this helps this movie feel, even though it was made in the '90s and you can tell it was made in the '90s, even like going off what you were saying, Andrew, how like it played it, a little light, and I get where you're coming from, but I think that's a bit of the product of the 90s and how most films were
free-flowing.
It was the, during that time, like this movie to me was almost like the like response to the grunge movement.
I was just about to say,
like all the characters with the shaggy hair and the I don't give a shit attitude, and like we're, you know, screw it, you know, the cynical look on the world.
Yeah.
And the counterculture that dealt with, you know, how you see they even say out the Reese Witherspoon character, you're this person, and all there, you know, the Cliff is like this person and all that. And I think that's still, keeping that divide is still very prevalent today. And I think they showcased that, I think, they really well. And it was funny, like, how you have these two lead characters, and I still don't think you really, you know, it's almost a message of the film, you still really not know them that well.
Yeah, and I think that's the idea too, right? I mean, it's the fact that, like, kind of touching on what Alex was saying, that they're kind of like products, really. That's kind of what they've thrown them out to be in a way, and they're just kind of exploiting them. So it's like you kind of know, like, a very little bit about them. I mean, you know, like, obviously the tragedy that happened, you find out kind of, like, full-fleshed, like, how, what all went down, even though you kind of know early on. But other than that, it's just kind of them going through this, like, crazy whirlwind of, like, the media and just, like, the world around them, like, obsessing over them because they were, like, put on TV and shit like that. I also wanted to touch, too, on, you were saying, like, you know, journalism and the fact that, like, you know, they make everybody products and things like that, and they kind of exploit them. And I think that's even worse, like, far worse, like, from people who've gone through, like, a tragedy, because people do that, you know, the media does that in general, but, like, even, you know, people have gone through like a major disaster or a tragedy or something like that. Like, it's kind of nuts that they're just kind of like, oh, you know, how do you feel, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, people are an investment at that point. They're a product to be invested in because you can exploit their feelings and their story for profit. So you take the case of SPAB, like TV, movies, maybe even a book deal. I don't think that was mentioned, but the possibility
but
was there.
But it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Three TV movies. Yeah, three. And only one was authorized.
But one thing...
Was it the Gary Coleman one, though? Probably that's what not. I want to know.
So damn what?
So damn what?
That killed me.
That was probably some of the funniest shit in the movie.
So damn what?
Yeah.
But one thing that I found interesting is that the character of Cliff Spab is not something... He's not... anyone that the media would have given two shits about in any other context. Like, he's 20 years old. He's just like a young guy. He's kind of a low life. He works at a burger joint. He spends his spare time smoking and drinking. He's not doing anything at this stage of his life. So he's not somebody that anybody would really care about until suddenly this happens to him and suddenly, ooh, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the character of his best friend, Joe, was the example of that, of like, he's a low life, no one gives two shits about him, and since that he's dead, they're not going to put two shits into him. Mm-hmm. He's just
you can't market a dead person, so. Yeah,
exactly, especially someone who, like, obviously, like, they were even saying, like, during the watching of the telecast that, yeah, no one gave two shits about you, they only cared about you and all the stuff you're saying. And, you know, Reese Witherspoon saying, like, you keep saying all this stuff, but I don't really think they know what you mean. And that little statement goes so far in comparing a lot of things, not just, you know, how people can, you know, dissect and twist words around, but also just movements, you know, in general, people following things just because it's either the it thing or they think it has greater meaning, or, you know, it's because they think it's the right moral thing to do, but really they don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just going at it face value. Just read a shirt, they read a quote, and they think this means everything. This will explain all their problems, and it doesn't.
Yeah, they think they know everything that they need to know because they saw it on TV or whatever, and they think, oh, they think they know these people now. Like, some of the reactions of, like, fans and crowds, mostly those that couple in the elevator, though, that they meet on their way up to their party. And, you know, he's just kind of, you know, trying to just do his thing, I guess, get through the semi-awkward situation. And, you know, he's surrounded by all these people who's like, oh my God, that's like so Spab. That's like so you. Yeah. And he's like, all right, sure. Like, I guess it is.
Yeah.
Even though I have no idea who you are, but I guess apparently you know me. Like,
yeah, it's funny, like, how little he actually changes throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really have an arc.
But again, I feel like that, like, my point, it relates to celebrity worship anytime, but still valid today as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we think we know these people based on what we're seeing. Like, it kind of gives us access to their identity as well. But, I mean, that's what the media wants, because that makes us more avid consumers of it. But it's really just...
I agree. I think the lack of character development and all that, I think actually helps with this to the strengths of the movie. Because...
What a rare thing to say.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, I didn't know much about this movie. That really worked.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if you were following too much about what they were thinking, what they were doing, what they were actually doing, because they were hinting at what actually happened, and they didn't really go too much into it. Like, yeah, they showed flashbacks as they showed more and more detail, but even then, they didn't really go into too much into, you know, they keep asking, how do you feel, but we never really find out how they actually feel, how they're dealing with it. And I feel like that's one of the biggest hidden themes of the movie, is how, like, you know, when they capitalize on this big event and all that, they spend more time of making it into an event instead of actually asking this real important questions. How are they all feel? Like, you know, they ask how they feel, but actually mean it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I loved when he's on the bed in the beginning and the camera's cutting back and forth from all the talking heads, all, you know, saying different things, like, especially the therapist. And there she's like, you can talk or not, but talking's good. But then talking's not good as well. Just like...
contradicting.
Just back and forth. You know, they all have their own little... Again, they all have their agendas of when something like this happens, because it's a sadly... not an uncommon thing to keep happening. Like, you bring up Room as an example.
Yeah.
I can just remember, I don't know how many stories there have been of like women or children or whomever has been kidnapped for like 8-10 years and all that. Then when they're released, just every, you know, Nancy Grace or whoever you can bring up, just talking to them, just asking them all questions, being sincere, but you can tell it's fake sincere because they just, they're, again, it's all for the cameras. It's all show business. I used to put it, Alex.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. There was, if you remember, the first interview, I think it was the first interview with Wendy Pfister. The interviewer, he says, we're going to spend an hour with Wendy Pfister in the privacy of her own home. Then he asks about SPAB, and her first response is, I must be very careful what I say about SPAB. You hear those exact same lines at the end of the film when he's interviewing Babs Wyler. And interesting to note, the actor's name is John Rourke. He plays five characters in the film. Phil Donahue, Sam Donaldson, Alan Dershowitz, Ted Koppel, and Larry King.
I knew it. I knew I recognized because I was like...
Larry King and him, I noticed, kind of look similar. I didn't catch the other three.
Phil Donahue, I was like, okay, something's up, you know, with these guys. But I didn't make the connection that was played by the same guy. Okay,
that's pretty cool.
Testament to that actor. He fooled me there. But I could tell, like, okay, there's Phil Donahue, there's Larry King, and then the... I don't know who the guy with the goatee and the obvious, you know, bushy eyebrows that are just drawn on and all that.
I think that was Sam Donaldson.
I'm not sure who that is.
Not sure.
Maybe in 90s, you know, famous.
Yeah, I don't know.
Those, like the Diane Sawyer of the day, you know, or something like that, who would just have the one-on-one interviews. Yeah. You know, those Barbara Walters ones.
And they're just like really deep, but like
and everyone cries and all that. So.
That's all it's for, really.
Yeah, it's really all
getting
for
emotion out.
Yeah, just to show, oh, these actors are human.
Yeah.
These people have some humanity.
Yeah.
But there are two conclusions you can draw from that alone, that one actor playing five different characters. Number one, if you're a casting director, you ask actors to do their best impressions of other characters in the film so you can save on having to audition other actors.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But number two, it was Conan O'Brien, I think it was last year or the year before, he had played a series of clips that were cut together of local news saying the exact same thing from the exact same script. I don't know what they were going on about, of course, but the exact same lines, verbatim. And
that's actually done pretty regularly on any political satire show. So if you look at Last Week Tonight, so you with John Oliver, or you look at Stephen Colbert, who, even though he's doing late night, he's still very politically charged. Mm-hmm. You look at guys like that.
There's Seth Meyers, too. He has.
Seth Meyers is very, late night is kind of picking up the mantle when it comes to political satire, actually. But honestly, if you look at them, they frequently do that because it is so ridiculous. They constantly take clips from all over, local news, national news even, and they play them side by side saying the exact same thing because that's what happens. They say this, they use the same talking points, even the same term, like terminology. They'll use whatever a certain party wants or a certain term that a certain political view wants them to put forward, and you'll see it repeated. So that happens frequently. Like I've seen it as recent as this week.
Yeah, no, they'll just send out.
It happens constantly.
Wow. Yeah, just the memos that get sent out, you know, from whatever higher ups, they'll send memos out to all the, you know, spokespeople or talking heads, and you're like, say this, don't say this, you know, this is the direction we want to go. If they ask you this, go here, all that stuff. So, you know, that doesn't even just work with, you know, with political candidates. This works with, you know, talking about, you know, the environment, gang violence, you know, housing issues, anything in the news. They have a set guidelines of how to deal with such issues because we've been dealing with this 24-hour news cycle for decades now.
Yeah.
So routines pop up and patterns always pop up of how to deal with things. And, you know, people were sick and tired of it then, but it's still happening. Nothing's really changed, so...
Well, I disagree a little bit just because I think we're constantly referring to mainstream media, to how mainstream media handles the news, which I understand it's a machine that's been built up over years. But nowadays there's been a disrupting force in everything being available online and so many voices being available online. It's kind of led to the splintering of news media in general, how people get their news. So now there's so many sources. So it gets to the point And again, you're seeing that it's very topical now just because, you know, the whole fake news movement and all that, where everybody's just constantly shouting that, to be honest, at anything they don't agree with, which is the wrong way of doing it. But at the same time, there is a they took something that was kind of factual, the idea that there's so much news out there now. A lot of it is fake, but there's a lot of better than mainstream news as well. There's news all over the place where some of it is very good and some of it is just awful and not true.
Oh yeah.
The mainstream sits somewhere in the middle where they're kind of, again, they've been built up as this machine that has to listen to certain, you know, special interests. However, you know, there is news out there. I think it's very different because when this film was made, there was there wasn't news like this. You couldn't go out and find reliable news or find a source that you really trust and follow them.
It's nowhere
you
near.
Only had so many options, right? So I feel like it's very much is a different time. So we can't forget that, because now with the way news is now is very different. Mainstream media is largely the same, and I think that's part of the problem.
There's just a lot more. Yeah, no, I agree with you what you were saying there, Andrew. I didn't mean to consolidate everything into one pile, but I do feel like, because even going off your point, how, like, you know, it wasn't as big as it was, say, it is now. It's just, you know, back then there was one, maybe two 24-hour news channels, you know. That CNN was the big one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now there's, like,
everybody.
Pick a country. so it's just, like, there's so many, and how it has been what's the word I'm looking for?
Has been commercialized?
Not commercialized. It's more stagnated, you know? It's very just everything has sort of been, you know, desensitized. That's the word I'm looking for. Because there is just so much of it out there now.
Yeah.
And I do feel like, yeah, there's the odd ones who, you know, stick to their actual... It's all good. We'll just keep that in for Andrew.
Biggity bam.
My bad.
Yes. I do feel like it is still a huge, I still feel like even the smaller companies, even the ones that are not as mainstream, no matter what they say, what they do, I feel like it is still, everyone has to follow certain guidelines and restrictions, and they follow an agenda, regardless on what issue you're pushing. I feel like that is still, you know, across all boards with media and journalism in all realms. I think that's never, I think that's only gotten worse. And I feel like it's kind of, it's peaking right now because it's everywhere. And the good ones are actually trying to get their voices out there, but they're being drowned out by the ones who are just spewing out nonsense. And I think this movie is just sort of like another, you know, we've seen, as we said, we've mentioned other movies that sort of have dealt with this issue of the media commercializing over tragedies or events or criminals, you know, natural born killers comes to mind as well.
There's a lot of movies in the 90s. It was actually kind of a big thing. Like you have like Ed TV and like even Truman Show and stuff that. Like there's a lot of them where they're like, oh, we're going to follow this subject. And it was a very common kind of thing. There's even some French movie. I think it was the first one to do it. And it was like 91 or something that did. I don't even know what it's called now, but this one was a little different because it, like, obviously didn't involve, like, it kind of involved following one person, but they were mainly following, like, the tragedy and stuff like that and just kind of exploiting all the people that were, like, involved with it.
It was a French film. It was, I think it was from 1993. It was black, filmed in black and white. It's called Man Bites Dog.
No, not that one, but I like that one. I do like that one. That one's crazy.
And you get, there's more.
So they see what I mean? Yeah. You see what I mean?
There's a black and white French film.
It was a thing that decade. Like, no, it was some Quebecois movie. So it was just about, like, following this one guy and his everyday life. So it's kind of like Truman Show a little bit. I don't remember what it's called now. But, it was kind of neat, too.
Yeah, the 90s seemed to have that down. You know? I think it wasn't. I think it almost was an answer to...
When it peaked with, like, Truman Show and
stuff. Yeah, with reality TV, the 24-hour news channel with CNN. I think those were all responses to that. And, you know, now we're living in the internet 24-hour news cycle with, you know, all these different channels.
Even beyond that, I mean, I got used to that. Having access to news on the internet... all the time, but it's gotten even worse to the point where I don't even bother. I don't care about being on the, you know, up to date as much as people feel that they need to, just because I don't need to know something instantly. You know, if I need to know it, I will know it. I will find out, you know, it will become news. It'll get around. Right. But there are, because of Twitter, that's just beyond me, because that came at a time when I guess maybe I was just used to the way that I consume news at that point. And now that's a way for people to get news in a much faster and more reliable way than reliably consistent, I suppose, than the news, the actual news, or even searching online, because it's a feed where people that you follow, is information spreads ridiculously quick, so you can find something out right after it happened, like within seconds of it happening, just because everybody's got a cell phone. A lot of people have Twitter, which pretty much everybody has Twitter, and they could tweet it, you know. You could snap it, you could do something like that. There are just so many ways to get it instantly now. I still haven't myself gotten into that or figured out a way to get into that, just because it's, I don't know, it just seems exhausting to me. And it also it puts you in a bad head, like in a bad space in your head, just because
negativity, like
constantly. So much negativity, because the world is a really messed up place, and to have that constantly on your phone or something that you're reading. I got to the point, I think it was last year, where it just put me in such a negative headspace that I noticed, and I was just angry or pessimistic or upset for like a good portion of time, and I realized it was just because I was consuming this negativity. So I you do need to disconnect big time. And like this movie's kind of saying that, like, we have such an interest in going down this rabbit hole and becoming a part of this and feeling strongly about, you know, whatever the issue is. Like those weird rednecks that he bumped into, they were like gonna shoot up some people, or like they were gonna like protect the cops and all this shit. And it's like, whoa, you're getting into this like crazy, you don't even know this guy, not really, but oh yeah, you're willing to get into this headspace where you're kind of becoming a little bit insane, right? I feel like news can do that to you, or like the media can make you feel a way that you're not.
Oh, it absolutely can do that. And like, as you were saying, like what you said you went through last year, I'm going through that this year.
I was just about to say,
just pretty much just like, you do got to disconnect yourself from this, because you're going to lose your grasp on what reality is. Because the more you just surround yourself with all this, you know, negativity, or these, you know, world's gonna end type of stuff, or like, you got to do something, why isn't anyone doing anything, it does mess with your perspective on things from time to time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the news has been so shitty recently, like in a number of things, even up to like today, like, you know, which is a ton of stuff, and it's just fills your headspace. You just want to like run into a cabin and like lock the doors and then have to fight demons.
I think that's the reason for the rise in political satire, is kind of almost, they're almost becoming more real news than they ever wanted to
absolutely,
be.
Absolutely.
Because they're reporting things that are real, but they're doing it in a satirical way. They're just trying to make fun of real news, but people are wanting to consume it that way because it's always so heavy. News is really heavy. These events, the things they're talking about are heavy topics, right? But they need to laugh a little, because if you consume this constantly, like, you want to know this stuff, but you don't want to, you know? And kind of making a joke of it is a way to make it easier to swallow. So you look at, like, that's why I mentioned Last Week Tonight earlier. He does give, they do their research there, and they present it in a way that is serious, but they always undercut it with a joke as well. Because they say, well, we're a comedy show. But at the same time, they are reporting on real things and trying... They have to walk this weird line where they're both entertainment and kind of serious, you know? And it's interesting. I think that's the shift we're going to, because everything's just too damn serious all the time.
I think that's kind of what this movie was... in terms of going way back to what you were saying, how like this movie is played a bit light, I feel like that's sort of what they were doing. It wasn't a full satire, but there was a little bit of satirical edge to it. I feel like the directing style of the movie, how the movie camera was shot, how it was moved, felt a little, you know, the camera at times was its own character in a sense. So, like, you know, the perspective moving back and forth and all that.
A lot of the frames that noticed seemed to be, the shots were framed up quite, like, tight and close and uncomfortable, like, yeah. filled with things and people, which adds to the feeling of being under constant scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, I feel like the tone of the movie, like, it could very well be a product of the times as well, because I did get a big 90s feel from mm-hmm. it, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, because, like I said, I enjoyed the movie. But also, I think it does... The humor element does help to make some of these serious topics more palatable as well as appealing to a broader audience.
Yeah, and Justice for All was 270s in a bad way, and SFW was 290s, I think, in a good way.
Yeah, and that's actually that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I definitely think it the time it was built, I don't think hurt this movie. I think it helped elevate a little bit. And the topic and subject matter that they were discussing, as we were talking about right now, it's still very relevant, still at the front of every newspaper. You know, we read all the things all the time, and nothing's changed. You know, you could, as you say, you can take, Conan O'Brien was putting stories, you know, of the same topic. You can take things from, like, 1999, something happened then, pair it with something happened today, and watch how, like, they dissect it, the pundits that talk, all that crap. It's the same stuff.
Yeah, they've got a template for each tragedy that happens.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, like how many hurricanes have gone through the U.S. over every year. And it's just like when you put it all in a supercut, you know, not much difference.
That's right.
So they start to lose their special importance, I guess, you know, just because there's so many and, you know. At the period we're recording this, you know, we've had, you know, the hurricanes in Houston and Florida and Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico is the most prevalent right now, but, you know, Harvey and the one in Maria or whatever was in Florida. Like, we're not even talking about that anymore.
Yeah.
And that was horrific what happened there. Like, cities were flooded. But now we're talking about the next thing that's going to happen.
It just always moves on, and that's kind of like what this film captures too, is it just, even though like the psycho like shoots them and stuff, it's like, oh, we're just moving on to the next thing, moving on. Yeah. Even if it's like super tragic and stuff, it's not really about that. It's about like, oh, there's this other thing that's jumped to that now because it's new.
Yeah, it seems like not just individuals now, but it seems like even stories now have their own 15 minutes of fame.
Right.
You know, it's just everything is just 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a total swing of the pendulum. You go from so fucking what to everything matters.
Yeah.
Because everyone's digested so fucking what so much, the media can see, well, they're starting to get filled up with that. So now let's go in the completely opposite direction. Yeah. Let's get their attention back and let's cram all the drama and shit we can into it to get the most out of the ratings and the money.
Yeah.
Because it's all about that cheddar.
I think that's human nature, though. They're just playing to human nature, is that when you have too much of one thing, you want the opposite. You want something different. You always want something different. So whether it's a political figure or it's like a style of movie, anything, people tend to like one thing, notice it drops off. And then what becomes popular in its stead, it's usually something very different, something that was almost the antithesis of what came before it. It's very common for that to happen. You see that all the time. Like, I you know, people used to say you would never have, or say that, you know, you never would have had an Obama if you didn't have a W. Bush. You never would have had a W. Bush if you didn't, you know, it's a cycle. It's a constant cycle of you always wanting something different, something to shake things up. The same goes with, I think, like news stories. And I think media understands that. And I think that the movie understood that to its credit. It understood that that's what people are always doing. They always want to latch on to something different. Yeah. And that's what that was. You know what? The film, I think it has these themes, and which is why I can appreciate it, which is why I don't dislike the film.
Yeah.
But as a piece of satire, it just didn't hit so hard for me, because I didn't think that it was that good at being satirical. That's the part where I think it fell short for me, because it was trying to be funny all the time, so it's trying to make light of something serious, but I don't think it handled either that well. Like, for me, it was, so when it was funny, sure, it was funny, but it wasn't also making a statement that I felt that had that much depth while it was being funny. Usually when you make a joke, it also, in terms of satire, it also has a profound point. And I didn't feel like it had that. It was just making a joke a lot of the time about a very superficial joke. That, so it was superficial satire in my view, just because it didn't go that deep. It didn't make me think that much when it made that joke. Like, oh, that's funny. Why is that funny? Because, oh, it's so true. You know, that's satire in a nutshell to me. So I didn't feel like it did that well. Okay. I thought that it did it fine. And the jokes were funny, which is important for satire. If you're not laughing, it doesn't really quite work. Or if you're not, like, enjoying it, then it won't really work. And if you're not thinking, it won't work. So it did both for me, just not that well. It didn't hit so much for me as it did for you guys, I guess.
Okay. So satire is criticism in a funny way. And kind of giving examples of that with jokes, perhaps.
Yeah, it's depth wrapped in some kind of a joke. In a rapper. Some kind of a rapper, basically. You're trying to give somebody something to digest that's difficult to digest in a way it makes it easier.
Palatable.
Right? It makes things... Exactly. Satire makes difficult topics palatable. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, as the old saying goes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Medicine is disgusting.
Yeah. So I appreciate the film for attempting that or doing that, you know, because I don't want to say it didn't do that, because it did. But the effectiveness to which it did that for me is hovering somewhere around, like, the, you know, 60-70 percentile, like how effective it was.
Gotcha.
So, it didn't quite make it there for me, which is why I'm, you know, I just can't be as enthusiastic.
The only other thing that throughout the movie that I thought was like, yeah, this is kind of, you didn't really need this at all, was the four voiceovers. There's only,
I didn't mind that.
I thought they were kind of tacked on. Like, they didn't really, they were sort like of
Harrison,
like,
Harrison Ford tacked on?
No.
Not that bad,
where it felt like you're literally spoon-feeding the audience and guiding their hand through all the emotions.
And ruining visuals.
And you have the actor handcuffed to the table.
Yeah.
With his lines.
But I don't know, these ones didn't really serve anything. To me, they were just generic voiceover lines to kind of, they were played over shots where they were hang on a little too long. Mm-hmm. I feel like they were just put there just to kind of keep the pacing up.
Probably.
Not really to serve a true story function or anything like that. And the stuff he was saying were very just like, okay, we could have guessed that's what you were thinking.
I honestly forgot there was even voiceovers.
Do you know what I mean? That's why I meant, like, that you didn't need them. They served...
Yeah, only the one in the beginning kind of really, like, registered. Mm-hmm. I didn't even notice there were four in total.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. They just came up, like, every 20-so minutes. I said, and they only came up, like, when he was walking to his friend's place to see his sister. And he's just like, we grew up from a block away from each other, and now he's dead. Waste of life. It's like... We knew that.
It's probably a pacing thing. I think you're dead on. It's probably just them trying to fill the gap of, like, oh, why just have him walking when we can, like, have him, like, say something.
Yeah, and then there was, like, another one with near the end when he's talking more about, you know, him and Wendy, I guess.
Yeah.
Or, again, just it didn't really matter, you know. If you really were to kind of keep the voiceovers throughout the narrative, you would have had an ending one. But there wasn't, if you're going to have one in the beginning, so...
Well, to be fair, though, for most of the movie, he is not allowed to see or talk to Wendy, who is the only other person alive on the face of the planet Earth who knows what he's gone through. And so that's, I imagine the voiceovers probably are there more for the audience's sake to kind of hear firsthand how this character is feeling. But there's that aspect to consider as well, that he doesn't really have anybody to talk to. Everyone who's willing to listen just basically wants to exploit him or make money off him. They don't actually want to understand or validate anything that he's gone through.
Yeah, but then I kind of feel like the voiceovers almost kind of then go against the whole narrative of the film of not trying to know this person. We only get him at face value. I feel like the few times that they play that, you know, for the first one, yeah, that's fine. But all the other ones, I don't think they added anything. Mm-hmm. I think they were just sort of, again, tacked on just to
I feel like that happened a lot in films from that era, though. Like, voiceover was like a studio must.
Most voiceover, right? And 90% of usually voiceovers you hear in movies, they're there because of why I just explained. They're there just to fill in the gaps. Yeah. Very rarely are voiceovers a key essential to the plot and to how the movie is structured.
Usually they're there because it's to explain something to the audience, right? And I feel like that's more of a statement of how the studios view the audience and that they need explaining. I feel like a lot of films, a lot of smart films, just let the audience figure it out for themselves or not. Like, I mean, it's really just up to you. If you don't get it, then fine.
Yeah, I just feel like this particular case was one of the few times I've seen where I was like, you didn't need that.
Well, I find narration in most movies just doesn't work. Like, I find in the majority of time when you have narration in a film, typically it's kind of like, did you need it? Like, obviously there's those films and things like that where it's like, okay, that was great.
Only Scorsese can do a good voiceover.
Yeah, but there's a lot of films, like there's countless where it's like, did you really need to? You know, like there's countless, so.
Yeah, this is, I don't know, that it just sort of, I was like, is this going to be a recurring theme? Is this something like we're going to see face value, but then you really get to know him through his voiceovers, you know, the constant, you know, he's being the one kind of saying everything that's wrong about the movie, everything that's happening in the movie that's like this bullshit, kind of furthering along, I guess, is what he was trying to say, I guess, when he was a hostage. But the fact that it was only really there just to serve as a story kind of purpose, or to kind of give something that, you know, again, brought his friend and all that, I didn't think it was necessary.
It would have served better if it gave more insight into how he was thinking.
Yeah.
Right? Just because that's kind of the point. Mm-hmm. Like, we just saw a movie where narration was used heavily, and it was for just one character's, his shifting thoughts, his shifting opinions. You never would have gotten that just by looking at him, because it was Brad Status, by the way.
Oh, I saw that too. Yeah, no, about. Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, well, yeah, you were with me.
Yeah, that's right.
You were all there. That's right. Yeah, I was there. No shit.
What are you talking about? Oh, yeah, you're
right. Like, that worked really well just because, you know, there's no other way to tell that story other than to be in his head.
Jack kind of disagrees.
No. Actually, I'll give you that. I wasn't as hot on that movie like you two were, but I will give you that movie was, you couldn't make it without a voiceover,
because he can't say this shit.
No, you can't. See, that's where voiceover really works, because it's half the movie, his dialogue is voiceover. So it's that's an instance where it does work with the narrative, with the structure, with the character. But in this case, it just felt tacked on.
Well, that's exactly, I think, the thing you need with narration is you need a purpose. I mean, obviously, if it's just filling it, well, then it can be kind of noticeable. But if there's an actual purpose, like with the character and Brad Status, you know, it has a purpose of being there.
If it's just describing what's on screen, that's infuriating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is kind of, I mean, I didn't quite do that in this one. He did give a little bit of insight, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, like, he was also just kind of describing some pretty basic shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, just, I don't know. That was one of the few things that came up. I was like, eh.
That's, again, if you're looking, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, I wrote that after just the second voiceover. I was just like, voiceover necessary? Just, I don't know. And then there was like one or two more. And I was like waiting. I was like,
no.
Nope. I stand by what I said. That was stupid. The other thing I will say, this is probably by far... I haven't seen a lot of movies with Stephen Dorff, but I think this is one of the best things I've seen from him.
I like Stephen Dorff.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I was gonna say that time when he got punched in the face and he's bleeding everywhere. I was like, oh, so that's how he got cast in Blade.
I think it was his attitude that got him cast.
Yeah, you're probably right.
A lot of that in Blade.
Oh yeah, and it was only like what, 4 years later.
Yeah. Blade came out like '98, so it wasn't too far.
Yeah, something like that.
And then Reese Witherspoon, just seeing, you know, she. I don't. It's so funny. She's one of those characters in this movie where if she was played by someone else, I don't think I would have really remembered her character too well.
Right.
It was because I guess this works well with the theme of the movie. I just said they're plastering her face all over, and really you just know. The only time you ever get to see any of those two characters be human being, is literally the last scene in the whole movie when they're both sitting in the beds.
Which is kind of awesome.
Yeah,
really.
I liked how that ended. I was like, oh, okay. But then when it cuts to that, I was like, oh, that's different. And then what they were doing, I was like, Oh, I like that. That's it, just I don't want to give too much away.
Even though we've kind of given away.
Well, we gave away everything, but not every single little detail. Right. But
well, it's like when the spotlight's off, hey, this is them.
Yeah, right. And I thought that was a little that was probably the most refreshing part of the whole movie, I think.
I liked it.
I really dug how it ended. So
I do want to say it's kind of funny though how the whole like hostage thing ended because they ran out of beer.
That was such a true statement he said. When he just said it, the reporter asked him, like, can you explain what happened? We ran out of beer. Yeah, totally.
Just and it's funny too when he actually, now that you mentioned that we ran out of beer, it's like, okay, they were in there for 36 days and they got held up in a liquor store. That's a lot of beer.
No, it wasn't a liquor store.
It was a convenience store.
Oh, I thought it was,
it's America.
Fun stuff, dude. Liquor stop.
Right, yeah. Sorry, I'm not used to it.
Wendy was 17. She shouldn't have been in a beer store.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
And Wendy Pfister, the character that Reese Witherspoon played, actually, Reese herself was either 17 or 18 at the time of filming, depending on when it was filmed, late 93, early 94. And the character of Cliff Spab was supposed to be 17, but when they cast Stephen Dorff, Stephen was 20 at the time.
Right. Mm.
So they changed the age of the character to 20, which makes a bit more sense considering the amount he smokes and drinks.
Sure.
Yeah. No, it was nice. It was interesting seeing Reese Witherspoon in a movie before. I think her breakout movie was Fear, right?
There was a lot of movies she did in the 90s. Yeah, Fear was one. She also did Election a little after that, like 99.
With Matthew Broderick.
Yeah,
right?
Alexander Payne was the director.
Right.
They did that one too. And then, of course, Legally Blonde.
Was the big one.
That
was in 2001. Right. This is like a long time before that. Yeah. So. Yeah, and then fucking
Tobey Maguire's standout performance.
Yeah.
And he was also breaking out around that time, too, because he was in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And
that was 97.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I was going to make a joke about, how he's in, all these drug movies, or he's, always,
I think Tobey Maguire's first movie was The Wizard. With the Nintendo.
Yeah.
Again, he's just standing there in next to who's the guy with the power glove? What's his name again?
I forget now.
Lucas.
Lucas. Yeah, he's just standing next to him and all that. So he's much younger than him, but seeing him in this, I was like, we both all recognize at the same time.
Sure.
shit. And then he's just complete stonehead. I was like, yeah.
Completely insane.
It was so great. That was probably the funniest part of the movie for me.
Was the friend playing Joe, the actor, is that the guy from Children of the Corn, Outlander?
Oh, it could have been. I mean, because, he kind of looked the same. And to be fair, Children of the Corn was not that long before, was it?
No, that was,
and he was, the older kid in that group. He was, much older than the other ones. He was kind of, probably, late teens or something.
Yeah.
So it would make sense that, you give it a couple years, and all of a sudden he's, I don't know, Children of the Corn was right around that time, though.
I can't remember.
I almost want to say it was even the same year. I thought it was 94.
Children of Corn was in the late 80s.
Was it?
Yeah.
Maybe I thought it was early 90s.
No. It was much earlier than that because you had Linda Hamilton in it. And I think Ted Danson.
Yeah, I think so.
I thought it was
early 90s.
I can't remember.
But if it was early 90s, then it probably wasn't. But if it was late 80s, that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. But no, he's the only actor I was like, who are you? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then there were the ones I didn't know, but,
Yeah.
He was the one I just kept saying, I've seen you before. I've seen your weird lips. Where have you been before?
I always look for the lips.
Yes.
It's like a young Hollywood Mick Jagger or something.
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, that's actually great. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, there you have it. SFW, January 20th, 1995. Stephen Dorff, Reese Witherspoon. Go see it. I was the only one out of the five of us who had seen or heard of it. The film grossed approximately $63,649, in total.
Oh, did it make some video back at least?
Damn. I have no idea.
Oh, how much was the budget, sorry? Have you found that out?
No, I don't think
it'd probably be $2 million, $3 million.
I don't even know if it went that far.
Yeah,
even if it's in that range, to make that much, clearly didn't make nearly enough. Yeah.
So go see it. Like I said, I was the only one out of five to see it, so that is number one, why I thought it was underrated.
Oh, sure.
And why it should be seen. There's an old saying that 1984 was not supposed to be an instruction manual.
Yeah.
And in much a similar vein, SFW was not supposed to be a template for how the media portrays real-life tragedies.
Mm.
But be like Cliff Spab and say, so fucking what? Well.